Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonzo reporting. Three bombs exploded in as many minutes in the city of northeastern Nigeria, killing at least seven people, according to witnesses and army on Wednesday. Authorities blame the Boko Haram Islamic extremist group. The attack happened in the densely populated suburb of Ajalari Cross on Tuesday night as residents, exhausted by daytime temperatures, were coming out of stuffy homes to enjoy the evening breeze. Meanwhile, an army spokesman said that seven people were killed in what appeared to be suicide bombing staged by Boko Haram. Britain's UN ambassador is accusing the Sudanese government of holding up delivery of food and other supplies for the joint UN-African peacekeeping force in Darfur. Matthew Rycroft told reporters Wednesday that the government is not complying with its obligation to support the force known as UNAMID. He said that he plans to raise a delay at the UN Security Council and with Sudan's UN ambassador. It's been going on for weeks and weeks, and it needs to stop, according to Rycroft. He said that the monthly cost for storing the shipments is currently $3 million and could go up to $13 million. Rycroft said the Sudanese government is denying knowledge of it. Egypt's state-run news agency says the Egyptian government is negotiating a $3 billion loan with the World Bank and another $500 million from the African Development Bank to finance its budget deficit. The Wednesday report from the Middle East news agency cites the finance minister, Hani Kadri Damian, is saying that the government is working on both the domestic and international front to finance its deficit. You're listening to VOA News. Rangers in Zimbabwe's Hwange National Park have discovered the carcasses of 26 elephants at two locations and additional victims of cyanide poisoning. The Bejani Trust and the National Parks and Wildlife Management Authority made the announcement Wednesday, a week after 14 other elephants succumbed to similar poaching tactics. According to the agency and to Bejani Trust, the 26 dead elephants were found on Tuesday. 14 tusks were recovered from these elephants and others were also removed but not recovered. A park spokeswoman said rangers found 16 of the elephants in an area known as Lupande before stumbling on 10 others. The London Royal Free Hospital says the condition of a nurse being treated for complications resulting from Ebola has worsened. The hospital said in a statement Wednesday that Pauline Kafferke is now critically ill after her condition deteriorated. Kafferke was treated for Ebola after returning from Sierra Leone last year. Three senior Turkish security officials have been suspended following the nation's deadliest terrorist attack in the capital of Ankara Saturday. Dorian Jones reports. We'll have that report for you shortly. Meanwhile, a delegation of Iranian lawmakers arrived in Damascus Wednesday in the buildup to a joint operation against insurgents in northwestern Syria and said U.S.-led efforts to fight rebels had failed. The delegation is being led by the chairman of the Iranian Parliament's National Security and Foreign Policy Commission, and their visit comes as Iranian troops prepared to bolster the Syrian army offensive that two senior officials spoke to Reuters that said would target rebels in Aleppo. And now we return to our report from Dorian Jones on three Turkish security officials who have been suspended.
Turkey's Interior Ministry says Ankara's provincial police chief and the heads of the city's intelligence and security departments were suspended Tuesday to allow what it said would be a healthy investigation into the bombings. The suspensions came as President Recep Tayyip Erdogan acknowledged that mistakes were made in preventing Turkey's worst terror attack. Erdogan and his ruling party-led government are facing growing criticism over the twin bombings that killed nearly 100 people and injured hundreds more. The president said he's using his executive powers to initiate an investigation into the attacks. He also claimed there was intelligence from Syria indicating an attack was being prepared ahead of the bombing. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
And French police officers are protesting what they call increasingly unsafe working conditions. Similar protests are planned around France. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yiswu Heeb, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Burundian officials say 10 people were killed Tuesday, including a journalist, his family and one policeman, during an attempt to rescue kidnapped police officers in the capital, Bujumbura.
That's Mohamed Yusuf reporting from VOA's East Africa Bureau in Nairobi. Details coming up.
Also, a major Swiss bank says migrants will add 5 million to Europe's current 340 million population over the next 5 years. And three suicide bombers killed at least 7 civilians in Nigeria's northeast yesterday.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas and Puga sitting in for Sunny, music from Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, a major Swiss bank has issued a forecast on the effects of the ongoing migrant and refugee crisis in Europe. Credit Suisse Bank says migrants will add 5 million to Europe's current 340 million population over the next 5 years. In related news, the European Union's Frontex, the agency that protects the external borders of the 28-member bloc, is watching refugee camps in the Middle East. It says there is potential movement of as many as 4 million political refugees living in Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan, and Egypt. They fled from armed conflicts in Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Also, Britain's Ministry of Defense says climate may also trigger more migrant flows to Europe. Reuters says military officials in London calculate that decertification in sub-Saharan Africa could force as many as 60 million people to relocate in North Africa or Europe. Leonard Doyle of the International Office for Migration says climate has created a new category of migrants from Geneva. Doyle spoke to VOA's David Arnold.
This is what we're trying to draw attention to, is a certain core group are indeed refugees and entitled to international protection under the 1951 Convention. But there's a large group who are there through no fault of their own. They are unaccompanied minors. They are people who've been trafficked in labor or sex trade. And indeed, this new group called climate migrants. So this is the danger we're drawing attention to, is they can't simply all be described as economic migrants and thereby deported. And we think that that would be a wrong-headed approach.
That then leaves the possibility that all the hundreds of thousands who have been entering Europe have a right to stay in Europe. Can Europe support that?
Well, Europe is a very large and wealthy place. It's certainly got the wherewithal to support people, far more so than the countries surrounding countries of conflict like Jordan, Lebanon, and indeed Turkey. But, of course, the politics of Europe are probably less likely to be able to support it. And that really is the issue, is how much can the politics sustain without the European politics itself becoming destabilized?
Do you think they can accept and accommodate all of those refugees politically?
I think provided they have good leadership, and in certain parts of Europe they have excellent leadership, I'm thinking of Germany and France in particular, provided they invest in good communications with their own host population, so they explain why it's important to have refugees, both for the self-interest of the people, for the wealth and diversity of the country, and indeed for purely moral grounds. Yes, they can do it, but they need to operate very carefully. They need to invest in good communication, and they need to make sure that they educate those incoming migrants.
And of the hundreds of thousands of migrants who have been descending on Europe in the last year and a half or 2 years, how many of those do you think are climate migrants?
It's a very difficult question to answer because there are many factors involved in migration, many so-called push factors. But we know that the environment is disappearing for many people, for many farmers, for example. We know that Lake Chad is now a puddle compared to a massive lake. And therefore, we know that many people have lost and are losing their livelihoods. And this expresses itself quite often in terms of civil strife. It might be Tuareg fighting with settled people in Niger. It could be even behind the war in Syria, where people have moved off the land because it's no longer supporting their families. They're in the cities, they're unemployed, and they're protesting in one way or another against the powers that be. So it's quite often difficult to say these are climate migrants, but we believe that climate is a stress factor in driving people into migration.
You mentioned West African countries. What about the rest of Africa?
We know that climate change is affecting people. How much it's affecting people remains to be quantified. And whether it's climate is the issue that tips it over the edge, or whether it's political violence or natural disasters, it's sometimes very hard to tell. Natural disasters are easier to tell, but so we think it's part of the mix and it's very much a strong driver of migration, but not the sole factor.
What will happen to some of those that politically in Europe are not going to be included? Can they be sent back home?
I think that's the danger, is that most will be sent back home, and we're just concerned that they not be sent home with too much dispatch, that they work carefully with the with organizations like International Organization for Migration, so that vulnerable people are protected, even if they don't fall under the specific 1951 Convention for Refugees.
That was Leonard Doyle of the International Office for Migration. From Geneva, he spoke with VOA's David Arnold.
Burundian officials say 10 people were killed yesterday, including a journalist, his family, and one policeman, during an attempt to rescue kidnapped police officers in the capital, Bujumbura. Mohamed Yusuf has more from VOA's East Africa Bureau in Nairobi.
Burundian police spokesman Pierre Nkurukiye says police launched a rescue operation after gunmen abducted three officers on patrol in the Ngangara neighborhood of northern Bujumbura.
Criminals, when shooting, they used some houses occupied by some families. Some members have been killed during the shooting between the criminals and the national police members.
Among the nine civilians killed was a cameraman working for state-run television. His wife and two children were also among the dead. Police contend it was the criminals' bullets that killed the family during crossfire. The head of the Reporters Without Borders Africa desk, Claire Kansreba, condemned the killing.
It seems to be that the police was conducting a raid in the neighborhood, and they broke down the door of this journalist and killed him, his wife, and his two children in a completely arbitrary way.
Witnesses and officials say some residential areas believed to be anti-government in central Bujumbura have seen multiple disarmament raids. Last month, the U.S. State Department called on Burundi's government to disarm all militias, including the ruling party's youth wing, the Imbonerakure, to prevent a further escalation of violence. Some residents accused the government of taking revenge against them for demanding that President Pierre Nkurunziza not run for a third term. President Nkurunziza was re-elected in July, but only after a wave of protest. His opponents said he was violating time limits in the constitution and the peace deal that ended Burundi's civil war. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Burundi has been dealing with unrest on and off since April, when President Pierre Nkurunziza launched his bid for a third term. But the conflict isn't just internal tensions, with neighboring Rwanda have steadily been on the rise. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig reports.
Relations between Central African neighbors Burundi and Rwanda, rarely warm, have been on the downswing in recent months. Here's Thierry Verculan, Central Africa Project Director at the International Crisis Group.
I mean, before the crisis, the relation was already a bit complicated, but with the crisis, there's been an exchange of accusations between Bujumbura and Kigali, and both capitals consider that the other capital is supportive of its opponents.
The crisis he refers to is Burundi's internal unrest. Opponents of Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza say his bid for re-election in April violated the constitution and the Arusha agreement that led to the end of Burundi's civil war in 2004, when the ceasefire was signed. A coup attempt in May and Nkurunziza's re-election in a poll boycotted by opponents did nothing to calm the situation. Rwandan President Paul Kagame also criticized Nkurunziza's decision to seek a third term and accused him of harboring a Rwandan rebel group.
Kigali accused the Burundian government of basically hosting or letting some elements of the FDLR to be in Burundi and to move more or less freely between Burundi and Congo. And at the same time, the Burundian government has accused Kigali of supporting its opponents.
Some Rwandans traveling to Burundi have reported arrests and beatings. Earlier this month, Burundi expelled Rwandan diplomat Desiree Inyarahuyira, whom it accused of trying to destabilize the country. Meanwhile, Kagame has been accused by Burundian officials of aiding the coup attempt and backing fighters in northern Burundi, allegations that Kigali denies. Steve McDonald is a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington.
Kagame and Nkurunziza, there is no love lost there. There's a long history of animosity, and Kagame, in my mind, is a Tutsi nationalist, and Nkurunziza is Hutu, but he tried to take the development in Burundi in a different direction, tried to move beyond sort of the ethnic dimensions in his first years of presidency.
But many analysts, including McDonald, believe the current tensions appear to be political in nature. The hope is that they do not take on an ethnic dimension later, if the crisis continues. For now, there's concern that Nkurunziza's re-election could represent a change in how the peace agreement signed in 2000 is viewed.
Basically, it means that the Arusha agreement is not going to be implemented anymore by the new regime.
And this disregard for the peace agreement could be one of Burundi's most worrying developments so far. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Swuhi, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. A major Swiss bank says migrants will add 5 million to Europe's current 350 million population over the next 5 years. And Burundian officials say 10 people were killed during an attempt to rescue kidnapped police officers in the capital, Bujumbura. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
In more news around the continent, three suicide bombers killed at least seven civilians in Nigeria's northeast on Tuesday. Red Cross officials and Army Colonel Sani Usman say the bombing attacks occurred in Kajeri, a community near the center of Maiduguri, the capital of Borno State. Usman says he believes yesterday's attacks were staged by Boko Haram insurgents. Maiduguri is the birthplace of Boko Haram, a militant force that has killed thousands and displaced 2 million people in a six-year effort to create an independent Islamic state.
As Sierra Leone continues its countdown to being declared Ebola-free, the country is also trying to recover economically and socially. VOA's Jackson Mfunganye is in the capital, Freetown. He spoke to Jody Kapua about recovery efforts now that the worst of the Ebola outbreak is over.
There's a sense of optimism that the tough days are behind them. The government has done a good job of communicating out to the people and working with different organizations. There's so many aid organizations here that are providing help to the Sierra Leonean government and the people in their recovery efforts. There's a sense of confidence among the people that the tough days are behind them. The countdown to being declared Ebola-free is, I think, around 25 days, and they're looking forward to that time when they'll be declared Ebola-free. They're very confident. I spoke to the spokesman of the president who stated that very soon, in sometime in November, Sierra Leone is going to be declared Ebola-free. You can tell from the mood of the people, from the economic activities, from the schools opening, that life is back to normal. I asked some people on the streets about how life was a couple of months ago, and they said things were pretty rough. There was curfew. Many of them stayed at home all days. Others were laid off from work. But things are pretty much back to normal now.
You spoke about the economic activities in Freetown, Sierra Leone, and I understand that the World Bank has a cash transfer program underway there to help communities recover from the Ebola outbreak. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, according to the spokesman in the president's office, Mr. Berete, who I had a conversation with yesterday, part of the post-Ebola recovery agenda that is going on right now, they're providing direct cash transfers to some vulnerable families This is sort of a pilot program in areas of Gwenadugu, Bombole, and other western areas where people were really hit hard, and many of these communities never had a chance to really fully recover. Many of them living below the poverty line. It affected their activities like agriculture. And they're hoping that this pilot program, which is a cash transfer program, will help them recover.
Well, Ebola certainly has affected just about everybody in Sierra Leone one way or another. And in the process of recovery, are you seeing problems such as stigma and discrimination regarding those families that were hardest hit?
Absolutely. You know, the sad thing here is also that the people who are the frontline workers and the most affected, who are nurses and other medical practitioners who had family members who died, are being stigmatized. Many of them complain that they have not yet fully recovered from this because society has yet to accept them. Neighbors won't talk to them. They will not interact with them. The people around are scared of them. One of them told me that their relatives will not come and visit them. They will not shake hands with them. They feel pretty much isolated. And this is for both the survivors and the medical practitioners who came in contact with Ebola at any point.
That's VOA's Jackson Mfunganyi from Freetown, Sierra Leone. He spoke to Jody Kepewa.
While tensions are high in Uganda since police arrested a leading female opposition member, Zena Fatuma, they stripped her naked public at a rally for presidential candidate Kizza Besigye. This is not the first time police have been caught on tape assaulting women at opposition rallies. Elizabeth Pala reports from Kampala.
Ugandan social media has erupted in outrage after raw footage of the arrest of top FDC member Zena Fatuma was made public. In the video, Fatuma, who is a member of the FDC's National Executive Committee, can be seen having her clothes pulled off by police officers as she is dragged down the side of the road. Fatuma says that she has been traumatized as a result.
Right now, as I speak, I'm still confused. I can't believe I'm an African woman. You know, when someone undresses me in public, it's really embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely embarrassing.
Yeah.
It's like the whole world has seen my nakedness. I feel ashamed of myself.
Mm-hmm.
Even moving on streets, I don't feel like moving.
Yeah.
I have kids.
Mm-hmm.
And my baby, she asks me, "Mommy, what is this?" And there's no how I could explain to my baby such things, the things which are happening.
Police contend that Fatuma was undressing herself, saying that using her naked body to protest is a culturally unacceptable tool to shock the public. They say this is evidenced by Fatuma's actions at the end of the video, when an officer tries to give her a shirt and Fatuma stands up and bares herself to the crowd. Fatuma says it was a final act of defiance.
By the time I reached the police pickup, I was completely naked. They got my top. They told me, cover it up. I said, now I'm tired, I don't want. You wanted to see? Let everyone see. And then after that, they were like, please cover yourself. I said, no, that's what you wanted. Let it be.
The situation conjures up an incident from 2012 when Ingrid Turinawe, another FDC activist, had her breast repeatedly groped by a police officer on Ugandan TV. Local activist Jacqueline Alisi wonders if the government is trying to scare women out of political participation.
I'm actually even seeing that very soon some of these rallies will be only for men. I don't know whether that is what they're intending, to make sure that women's voices are not heard. But as a woman, traditionally, a creature called the woman is supposed to be respected.
Fatuma says that although the incident has been difficult, she still plans to support Kizza Besigye on his upcoming trip to eastern Uganda. She also says she is planning to sue the police officers involved, as well as the Inspector General of Police. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
A leaked letter from the Democratic Republic of Congo's Electoral Commission says the panel has not received the funding it was allocated for upcoming elections. As a result, preparations for the vote are being delayed. The news came the day after the commission's president resigned. Nick Long has more from Goma in eastern Congo.
The Electoral Commission, known here as the CENI, was reacting to a statement by a government minister who said the CENI has enough funds to do its job of preparing for national, provincial and local elections between now and the end of next year. Hans Hobecker, an analyst for the International Crisis Group, follows the DRC's electoral process. He says the CENI wrote a letter to the government saying that since 2013 it has received only 17% of the budget it was allocated. Government spokesman Lambert Mende declined to comment on the figures. But Mende did say that the budget approved by Parliament for the CENI of more than $1 billion seems excessive for a country with a total budget of only $8 billion and was based on the assumption that external donors would help pay, which they now seem reluctant to do. Hobecker described the budget as monumental. He says they could do the job for a lot less, and both the budgeting and the whole electoral process are far from transparent. Hobecker told VOA he visited the CENI's offices in Katanga province recently and saw a risk of enormous waste. He says equipment and material that he saw are dilapidated and they have vehicles that haven't been used since 2011. He says he's heard that ballot boxes from the last election are now widely used as rubbish bins. The letter from CENI's staff casts more doubt over the DRC's election process. The process already suffered a blow in the past week when the chief of the Electoral Commission resigned, citing health reasons. Opponents of President Joseph Kabila have expressed concern he wants to postpone next year's presidential vote in hopes of staying in office beyond his second term. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
The World Food Programme says more than 40,000 people have been displaced in recent days by new violence in Central African Republic. The UN agency says the surge in violence occurred in the capital, Bangui. At least 77 people are reported dead and more than 400 injured. The WFP says it has managed to provide assistance to about 30,000 of the newly displaced after being forced to suspend aid operations for several days. It calls the displacement a step back in recent efforts to rebuild the country following years of internal conflict. In all, nearly 900,000 people are displaced within the CAR.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. A major Swiss bank says migrants will add 5 million to Europe's current 340 million population over the next 5 years. And Burundian officials say 10 people were killed during an attempt to rescue kidnapped police officers in the capital, Bujumbura. Coming up, we'll have music from Uganda. And in our feature segment, we look into the Nigerian community in South Africa. I'm Kim Lewis with Yuhaya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And it's time now for sports with the mighty, mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sonny Young this week. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Kim.
What's on tap today?
Well, Kim, we'll kick off with the FIFA 2018 qualifiers.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Chad and Comoros both earned away goal victories on Tuesday to progress to the next round of the 2018 World Cup qualifiers. Comoros are ranked number 193 in the latest FIFA World Rankings and managed a 1-1 draw in Lesotho, and that was the same score on aggregate. The tiny island nation will now play against Ghana next month. Chad lost 2-1 to Sierra Leone in the second leg of their tie, but progressed thanks to that away goal rule. Chad, who are currently ranked number 175, will now play as seven-time Africa champions Egypt in the next round. Meanwhile, the second leg of Swaziland's tie with Djibouti in 2018 World Cup qualifiers will now be played on Saturday. The match was due to be played yesterday, Tuesday, but was postponed for what FIFA said were logistical reasons. The National Football Association of Swaziland has confirmed the match will kick off at 14 hours GMT at the Somholo National Stadium in Lobamba. Swaziland hold a 6-0 lead from the first leg and are favourites to advance to play Nigeria in the second round. Reports in Swaziland said Djibouti squad were stranded in Kenya. Now, for more sports news, let's go to Johannesburg, South Africa, and join Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma. Mark has more on the FIFA 2018 World Cup qualifiers.
Namibia's brave warriors came from behind to edge Gambia 2-1 in the return leg of the Africa Preliminary 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifier in Windhoek on Tuesday. The brave warriors advanced on a 3-2 aggregate. Madagascar and Central African Republic drew 2-2 in Antananarivo. Madagascar win 5-2 on aggregate. Burundi beat Seychelles 2-0 in Bujumbura to advance on a 3-0 aggregate. Sierra Leone pipped Chad 2-1 in Port Harcourt, River State, Nigeria. However, with an aggregate of 2-2, Chad carried the day on their away goal rule. Comoro Islands also cashed in on their away goal advantage following their 1-1 draw with Lesotho in Maseru. Elsewhere, Botswana outwitted Eritrea 3-1 in Francistown to prevail with a 5-1 scoreline. Niger outclassed Somalia 4-0 in Niamey to win the tie 6-0 on aggregate. Liberia dismissed their hosts Guinea-Bissau 3-1 in Bissau to progress on a 4-2 aggregate. Mauritania overpowered South Sudan 4-0 to advance courtesy of a 5-1 aggregate. The tie between Swaziland and Djibouti in Lobambo will be replayed after the match was abandoned. Meanwhile, the Republic of Congo edged Benin 2-1 in Brazzaville as Algeria pipped Senegal by a solitary goal in Algiers in friendlies played on Tuesday. In kickboxing, Australia's Piotr Lagodzki is the new World Kickboxing Federation Intercontinental Welterweight Champion following his fifth-round technical knockout of Ugandan defending champion Umar Semata in Kampala, Uganda on Sunday. Finally, in athletics, Tanzanian defending champions Dixon Marwa and Anastasia Range line up to defend their men's and women's crown at the Rotary Half Marathon in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania today, Wednesday. They face a field of challenges drawn from Burundi, Ethiopia, Kenya, Malawi, Mozambique, Namibia, Rwanda, South Africa, and Tanzania.
That was Mark Homer. Thanks very much for that report. Now, meanwhile, former South African Football Association, SAFA, official Lindile Kika, has been suspended from all football activity for the next 6 years. The sanction has been handed out by the Independent Ethics Committee of the Football World Governing Body, FIFA. Details of the case were not provided, with FIFA saying it was in relation to several international friendly matches played in South Africa in 2010. Kika has repeatedly denied allegations of match fixing from 2010. He was one of the five senior SAF officials, including the former president, Nema Thandani, put on special leave in December 2012 following a FIFA report into match fixing. He and the others were reinstated in January 2013, but not exonerated from any wrongdoing. A meeting of SAFA's executive committee at the time decided the emergency committee went beyond their mandate in suspending the officials.
This is Larry Zamuje, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 18.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner the VOA. VOA! And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 88.9 Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to sports radio, 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Talking of keeping it sporty, as Sunny said, the Sunny Young is still in Lagos and he'll be meeting and broadcasting with our friends at Brilla even today, October 14th. In athletics, a two-time world marathon champion, Abel Kirui, will be looking to recapture the form that saw him triumph in Berlin in 2009 and Digu 2 years later at the TCS Amsterdam Marathon this coming Sunday. Now 33, the Kenyan police chief inspector will be having his first outing since failing to finish at the Boston Marathon in April. His last completed marathon was in Amsterdam 12 months ago, when he finished sixth in 2 hours, 9 minutes and 45 seconds. Kirui has not run under 2 hours, 8 minutes since the 2012 London Marathon, just a few months before he returned to London and took the silver medal at the Olympic Games that summer. The Amsterdam Marathon course record stands at 2 hours, 5 minutes and 36 seconds and is held by his compatriot Wilson Chibet from 2013, and the three-time winner Chebet, who was victorious in consecutive years between 2011 and 2013, will be among Kirui's rivals as he strives to regain his title. Among the other four names announced on Tuesday by the organizers of this year's Amsterdam Marathon was Ethiopia's 31-year-old Marcos Kenetti, who will be the second fastest man in the field. He set his personal best of 2 hours, 4 minutes and 54 seconds at the 2012 Dubai Marathon, where he placed third. Genetti's 33-year-old compatriot, Dandi Yami, finished sixth in the 2012 Dubai Marathon in 2 hours, 5 minutes and 41 seconds, which remains his personal best. His most recent marathon was in Seoul earlier this year, where he was fourth in 2 hours, 8 minutes and 5 seconds. The third of the trio of Ethiopians, Yafeyesi Bekele, is familiar with the Amsterdam Marathon, having run what is also his personal best of 2 hours, 6 minutes and 26 seconds when finishing fourth. Kenya's Eliud Taras will be making his marathon debut, but is an accomplished runner over shorter distances and can boast of a best of half marathon best of 1 hour, 4 seconds. In addition to Wilson Chibet, the race organizers have also announced that Kenya's 2014 Amsterdam winner, Bernard Kipyego, will defend his title.
Hello, sports fans. This is Paul Tergat, marathon champion from Kenya. You are listening to the Sony side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
And finally, on to tennis. Britain's Andy Murray had a comfortable 6-2, 6-4 victory over Steve Johnson in his opening Shanghai Masters match. He'll face another American, John Isner, in the third round. Isner's 6-3, 7-6, 7-5 victory over Belgian David Goffin prevented a dress rehearsal meeting between the world number 16 and Murray before next month's Davis Cup final. World number one Novak Djokovic also reached round three, beating Slovakia's Martin Klizan 6-2, 6-1. And that's it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Impoga. Now back to you, Kim.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, South Sudan desperately needs aid from the West. And next, we look into the Nigerian community in South Africa. But first, some music. Here is Giorgio Kudi from Uganda with Africa Survival.
Bafana, Bafana, and Nelson Mandela.
Watch out, the man. Little children suffering by looking for survival. Ah, in Africa, tonight. Everybody's fighting for survival in the street. Ah,
Africa, I'm coming through my Nebadilika.
America,
you can't.
Bobimba. Zonda to yo kili danda. Dar es Salaam, Kigali, Johannesburg. Répète-toi, répète-toi, la danse, la musique, Eza de Jésus Christ. Okudi, Mwana Kora. Washington DC, hein? Angalia kala katoto kamevala tiki 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 tibom chimoto kachinane chimoto le chitono katoto kamelia kanataka kulala ma bona nilipata na wale wale pita pata pata ya pata pata ya putum pata pata ya pata pata ya bam pata pata ya pata pata ya chikang kang chikang kang chikang boom vala kutokana na makadona sasa katika na muziki paka Nairobi. Je suis là. King Jesus of Jerusalem, welcome to Kampala. Hotel Juan de Kigali, la proclamation internationale.
George Okudi from Uganda with Africa Survival.
Yes, nice song. Well, British Prime Minister David Cameron recently announced the deployment of several hundred troops to South Sudan and Somalia to shore up stability. But aid groups say South Sudan desperately needs other forms of aid. Henry Ridgewell reports.
South Sudan descended into civil war in 2013, just 2 years after gaining independence. The United Nations peacekeeping mission involves over 12,000 troops from dozens of countries. British Prime Minister David Cameron announced Monday that up to 300 soldiers would join the mission. A further 70 British troops will be deployed to work with a UN force supporting the African Union's peacekeeping mission in Somalia.
It's in our national interest, not just living up to our international obligations, but we will benefit if Somalia has a future free from extremism. We will benefit if South Sudan as a country can function and not drive huge numbers in terms of migrants across the Mediterranean.
The British troops will not play any combat role, but will instead provide combat training and logistical support. The deployment is unlikely to achieve Cameron's desired outcome, says Marika Shomeris, a South Sudan specialist in London.
There's clear cause and effect. The UK sends 70 troops to Somalia, 300 to South Sudan. There will be less terrorism and less migration. It just does not exist. So there are other interests and other reasons why it's a good idea to contribute to a UN peacekeeping missions, but it's not to address migration or terrorism in the UK.
Rival government and opposition forces in South Sudan signed a peace deal last month, but sporadic fighting continues. 40% of the population is reliant on food aid. The UN says that unless malnutrition treatment is increased immediately, 50,000 children are likely to die. Aid workers say it's vital the peace deal holds.
We're now delivering food aid, nutrition programs, other items that people are in desperate need of. So we're very positive, and this has only happened since the signing of the peace agreement.
Donor countries should look at other ways of helping South Sudan, not just by sending peacekeepers, says Shomeris.
It does mean to rethink the engagement with the government. And this is where, of course, the donor countries have been struggling, because the government and the rebel side both have been implicated in atrocities in this war.
Aid agencies warn that the world must act fast to avert a desperate shortage of food, or the toll from the conflict could rise sharply. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The Nigerian community in South Africa is not happy with the negative image given to it by South African authorities. A diaspora social group in the country, the Nigerian Union, is worried that crimes committed by citizens of other African countries in South Africa are blamed on Nigerians. One way of identifying its citizens is the introduction of identity cards for Nigerians living in South Africa. The union wants all Nigerians in the country to carry identity cards with vital data of the individuals to resolve misunderstandings. VOA reporter Tony Tamuno spoke to the president of Nigeria's union in Pretoria, South Africa, about the need for those cards.
With the English Africa service of the VOA on this interview session is Mr. Ikechi Gwanyene. He is the president of Nigeria Union, South Africa. Welcome, sir.
Yeah, welcome. Good morning.
Sometimes in June 2015, the union launched the Nigerian ID card project in South Africa. Can you tell us what it's all about?
Okay, we want to use the ID card as a means of identifying all Nigerians in South Africa. It will also help us to have a good database of Nigerians in South Africa. There is also a problem we noticed that non-Nigerians claim to be Nigerians, especially when they are at the wrong side of the law. So with this ID card, it will help us know who exactly is a Nigerian in South Africa.
What are the main problems that the union is having, and do you have solutions to them?
Many South Africans believe erroneously that Nigerians and Africans in general are the source of their problems. We are tagged as criminals to the point that they believe that numerous professors we have in the country do one crime or the other. But the truth is that Nigerians are very hardworking people. If you don't understand a Nigerian, the way we operate, our entrepreneurial endowment, you will actually believe that we are criminals. For instance, a Nigerian can be hardworking in the street, denying himself of luxury till he finishes his doctorate degree, or even raises money to start importation business or things like that.
Following from what you just said, has the union come across people or suspected Nigerians who are believed to be thieves?
You hardly see a Nigerian thief in South Africa. Rather, what you see is hardworking artisans.
What is the situation of Nigerians here? Is the situation different from people like, let's say, Zimbabwe refugees?
Yeah, Zimbabweans are given preferential treatment by the Home Affairs officials. Also, they are part of the SADC countries, so it is much easier for them to be regularized and work in South Africa.
Within the union, do you have open hostility here in South Africa?
We live mostly peaceful with our South African hosts, but there are still some hostility due to ignorance and poverty.
Do most Nigerians living in South Africa mix or marry in South Africa?
Most Nigerians are married to South African women and have become part of the community. All our social, family, and economic life is now in South Africa.
Can you compare life in South Africa and Nigeria?
It is always better to live in your own country because of ancestral and some other sentimental attachment. But South Africa has equally offered a lot of opportunity to us.
May we know why you stay here in South Africa with other brethren from Nigeria? Why do you stay here in South Africa?
I came here in the 90s to seek for better opportunity. But along the line, I started business, married, and have children now. And that's why I'm in South Africa, because I built my life in South Africa.
Does the union have any programs to build relationships with the police or with the public?
We have set up Nigerian South Africa Friendship Association. We also do a lot of charity work in South African communities. We also have enlightenment programs We cooperate for regarding the police. We cooperate and support the law enforcement agents all the time to do their job. We have a working relationship, a very good working relationship with the police in South Africa.
Mr. Nyane, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly condemns the dual explosions in the Yanya and Kuji areas of Abuja on October 2nd, and the suicide bombings and militant attacks in Maiduguri and Adamawa on October 1st. We extend our deepest condolences to the families and loved ones of those killed and injured. These tragic events are stark reminders that violent extremists will stop at nothing to inflict horrific and indiscriminate harm upon innocent civilians. In particular, Boko Haram's reign of terror and sheer brutality have left thousands dead and millions displaced. To assist those nations threatened by Boko Haram, President Barack Obama recently delegated authority to the Secretary of State to direct the drawdown of up to $45 million in defense articles and services, as well as military education and training to support Benin, Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Nigeria's efforts to defeat Boko Haram. This will enable the Secretary to authorize the provision of critical airlift support and other assistance, including to help the Lake Chad Basin countries move troops and equipment to the border region from which Boko Haram terrorists continue to launch brutal attacks on civilians. This assistance builds on training, equipment, and logistical support that the United States is providing using other authorities. The United States also continues to provide advisors and share information with our regional partners to enhance counter-Boko Haram operations, as well as victim support and counter-violent extremism programming. Since 2009, Boko Haram has killed more than 10,000 people, devastated communities, and left deep scars in the lives of those affected by its violence. Boko Haram's indiscriminate violence has created more than 2 million internally displaced persons and over 200,000 refugees throughout the Lake Chad Basin region. Defeating Boko Haram will require a holistic campaign that protects human rights, pairs progress on development and governance with security measures, and fills in behind military successes with civilian stabilization efforts. The United States stands with our partners in the region who are fighting to end Boko Haram's campaign of terror that threatens to rob an entire generation of the benefits of unfettered access to education, health care, and economic development.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
African music mix.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.